You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, April 18th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Dayan on the hidden monopoly driving drug prices, and also on President Gary Cohn. Meanwhile, Theresa May calls a snap election in the UK, and a preview of the big special election taking place in Georgia's 6th today. SCOTUS blocks an Arkansas execution plan, essentially. It's disgusting. They're racing because their death serum is going to expire in a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, you people are crushing it in town halls across the country, while President Trump praises Turkey's Erdogan for becoming a dictator. Goes on to confuse who is the leader of a country he may bomb. Also, Trump to overhaul a visa program for skilled workers while quietly but viciously targeting immigrants on a daily basis.
I'm becoming George W. Bush. It's great.
The next threat to the Affordable Care Act, United Health makes big money by leaving the exchanges. The emolument suit gains strength while Ivanka secures trademarks for her products in China, coincidentally, after meeting with the Chinese Prime Minister.
Synchronicity.
Yes.
Same day.
But
synchronicity.
Just a coincidence,
things
I'm sure.
Things happen to good people.
All that and more.
Isn't that
on
that Jew Rabbi's
today's
book?
Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. As you can tell, Michael and Kelly and Matt are here.
When good things happen to tremendous people.
And we should say that David Dayan will talk about this. We actually did this interview yesterday because David Dayan, right now as we speak, is probably primping himself. In preparation for testifying in front of the California State Legislature about the topic in which we're interviewing him on today. We actually interviewed him yesterday. I spoke to him on Ring of Fire about this topic a couple of weeks ago and was contemplating just playing that, but I wanted to get an update from him on it and also talk to him about Gary Cohn, because that ties directly into the radical changes. That may be overselling it a little bit, but the significant changes in Trump's policies towards China. Radical, probably, if you measure it from the campaign. But he has made his transition quite seamlessly, it seems, from the supposed non-interventionist America firster on trade to just basically Jeb Bush.
I said, look, Steve, you can call him chinks all you want, but there's patents we need. And stop bothering my son.
Indeed. And I think it could very well just be that. And meanwhile, you know, this is, you know, I continue. Last night I went on a Chris Hayes' program with someone who was, you know, perfectly reasonable. Her name was it Evelyn Farkas? She was a former, Clinton national security person. she wasn't particularly in supportive of Trump's moves, but there's a, you know, there's this sense that, like, you know, all of the responsible people now on the National Security Council, they'll save us. And in the best of times, these people are, I think, tend to be a little warmongerish. And now they're supposedly the voices of reason. I mean, it's quite clear that President Obama did not want to attack Syria. And to the extent that he was coming close to doing it, it's quite clear now that it was all of the advisors around him who were supportive of it. And I don't know that this, you know, and it's clear because all of the former Obama officials who have come out in favor of an attack on Syria and praising Trump for it. And if I recall correctly, there was supposedly a slip of the tongue by John Kerry at one point, which invited Russia into the picture and led to essentially the deal on chemical weapons, which avoided an attack on Syria at that time. And I would not be surprised to see people revisit that time period and see that this was Kerry and Obama basically saying, let's bypass the entire sort of infrastructure that is pushing for this, and let's just pretend you screw up. I mean, one has to wonder. You know, we saw some dynamic like that with Biden, with marriage equality. And you wonder if this wasn't just sort of like one of Obama's leading from behind things, which at least if you're one of those people who did not feel that we should be involved in direct hostilities as opposed to sort of, I guess, paying or providing means in which for weapons to get to Syria.
It also makes sense historically because, I mean, Kennedy, people know that his advisors were more hawkish in a lot of ways, but also Nixon was spied on by the Joint Chiefs of Staff because he wanted to open up to China. So, like, those sorts of influences are always there permanently to, you know, play on the president.
That's actually what the deep state is. That's actually what the deep, it's not a, just a bunch of Obama advisors who
are
there.
Well, yeah, okay. Whatever you say. Allahu Akbar.
But for those people who are convinced that because McMaster's is sitting on the National Security Council, that we won't do anything rash, remember, it is this guy, for some reason, on the lawn of the White House. Maybe this is during the Easter egg hunt, which apparently they screwed up. They couldn't even run an Easter egg hunt. They actually had to have Obama staffers, members of the deep state, come back and help because apparently Melania Trump has no staff. And traditionally, the first lady runs the Easter egg hunt or something. So literally, almost everyone who executed the Easter hunt were former Obama staffers who just came back.
That's got to be a movie.
Exactly. But here is Donald Trump talking about how he's not going to reveal any of his plans because and then also not only is he not going to reveal his plans, he's also not going to reveal that he knows who is now the current leader of North Korea.
The vice president is in Asia doing the four-stop tour, and he said basically the U.S. is running out of patience. Clearly a message to North Korea. You have a Navy fleet that is sent into the Sea of Japan right now. Have you ruled out a military strike?
I don't want to telegraph what I'm doing or what I'm thinking. I'm not like other administrations where they say we're going to do this in 4 weeks, and that doesn't work that way. We'll see what happens. I hope things work out well. I hope there's going to be peace. But, you know, they've been talking with this gentleman for a long time. You read Clinton's book, he said, oh, we made such a great peace deal, and it was a joke. You look at different things over the years with President
Obama. Pause it for one
second. Everybody has been outplayed. They've all been outplayed.
Now, as you know, President Clinton left office in 2000. Now, this guy that they've been making the deal with, Kim Jong-un, has been in office since, what, 2011, I think.
I think, yeah.
And so maybe, what's that?
Do we call it an office?
Well, he's
been in power.
Now, maybe, Clinton just like said, I'm just dealing with the kid.
I'm bypassing the dad. I just want to know what the youngster has to say. And by the way, that was a great deal. I like how Trump, not only is he wrong, he always like, there's a line in Clinton's book where he randomly sounds like Donald Trump, where he just is like, and then we went to North Korea where we completed the greatest deal ever because I make great deals. Well, no one makes better deals than me.
You can imagine maybe that, Kim Jong, Clinton sitting having dinner with Kim Jong-il to make the deal. And he said, oh, let me meet your son. Oh, come on over here. Here's the secret deal.
All right. Here's what we're going to do. You want this special issue of Playboy or not? You're 13. Come on. You know what you want.
All right. But, to be fair to Trump, maybe he just refers to, let's just pull it back, because maybe he just refers to North Korea as that guy. Okay.
Things work out well. I hope there's going to be peace. But, you know, they've been talking with this gentleman for a long time. You read Clinton's book. He said, oh, we made such a great peace deal and it was a joke. You look at different things over the years with President Obama. Everybody has been outplayed. They've all been outplayed by this gentleman. And we'll see what happens. But I just don't telegraph my moves.
I always refer to a country's gentleman.
Look, North Korea is a gentleman.
Not a lady, because they're ugly.
Because they're ugly. North Korea, by the way, North Korea, I call it a gentleman because if it was a girl, it wouldn't even be a two. That's how bad it is. And by the way, that's how seriously we take it. Unlike Obama, also, who was like, in 4 weeks, I am going to send malware to Iran. Heads up, everyone.
Exactly.
Fair warning. And again, in advance, I apologize.
Ben Norton. Right. And also, let me just plant this let me just go out on a limb here and say, I don't think he read Bill Clinton's book.
Then we completed the greatest, most fantastic peace deal ever made over chocolate cake in Mar-a-Lago. That's like literally how he reads it. It's like, they came to Mar-a-Lago, they had my chocolate cake, and they made a deal that was a terrible deal, but they made it where I was.
All right, before we get to David Dayen interview, let's also just briefly talk about what's going on today in Georgia. As you know, there is a special election in Georgia's 6th District. This is the district that Tom Price, who is now Health and Human Services Secretary, used to sit in. Price won that district by 23 points. However, Donald Trump won that district only by about a point and a half. So there's a sense that there's a certain anti-Trump sentiment in that district relative to how Republican that district is. Mitt Romney beat Barack Obama there in 2012 by about 22, 23 points. So this has basically a partisan index, and the way that they measure this apparently with congressional races is to take the average of the last two presidential elections. That's generally how it's done in an off year or a special election. So there's about a 10-point, more or less, favor to the Republican in this district. And apparently, according to 538, there are 47 Republican-held House seats that are more Democratic-leaning than the Georgia 6th. Democrats need to pick up only 24 to win back the House. So it gives you a sense of where this fits in the broad spectrum of House seats come 2018. This race is important as a signpost to give people a sense of just how much of an opportunity there may be for the Democrats to take over in 2018. But more importantly, what it does is it also will scare. Let's say this guy drives 46, 48, 50% of the vote. That sends a message to those other 47 Republicans who are in more Democratic-leaning districts that, oh, we could get in trouble in this midterm if we stick with Trump. And so that's why this is important. Just as that Kansas election sent a message to Republican lawmakers, like, you may not want to associate yourself with Trump very much, so too will this district. Now, there's like 15 people running in this race. It's an open primary. 11 Republicans, 5 Democrats, so 16. If nobody gets to 50%, there will be a runoff between the top two people. It will obviously be more difficult for the Democrat to win in the direct runoff, although not impossible. He's raised $8 million. I'm talking about John Ossoff. He is not a, he's not the, he does not have the profile of a Democratic congressman that you would want from a blue state. He is basically, my guess would be, broadly speaking, those things that you may or may not have liked about Hillary Clinton, he is probably like that plus.
He's a better together guy.
He's a...
The better together.
Better together.
Line, like, we all just come together, let's get above politics.
Yes. He's like a no-labels type of guy, I think. I mean, broadly,
I don't know if he's quite that bad, but right. Yeah, he's also more in that lane.
It's tough to find out, frankly, what... He's been running a basically anti-Trump campaign.
Yeah.
It's not quite clear where he is, but there's no reason to believe this guy is a...
He's also, let's be, you know, honest here. He's running in a district, which you already basically explained with the numbers, where the Clinton campaign's theory, which nationally was delusional, but it actually is one of the only districts where it kind of makes sense, of like affluent Republicans that are specifically repulsed by Trump. So he's running that campaign, and obviously I would doubt he's going to be some type of progressive crusader, but...
Right.
It matters.
Right. It does matter because, I mean, at the end of the day, 24 Democrats taking seats in this midterm elections means investigations, means basically control of the committees. So that's pretty important. So, and here's the three things to look out for tonight is if you're looking at results. There's three counties. Cobb, DeKalb, I've been told now. Not DeKalb, as we call it up here. It's DeKalb and Fulton. Cobb has the largest share of white voters. Can anybody guess how Cobb went in the in terms of Trump? Trump carried Cobb by 15 points. DeKalb has the largest share of black voters, 16%, and is also the most Democratic. Clinton won it by 19 points. Fulton provided about half of the district's vote, and Fulton was won by Trump by 3 points. So that gives you a sense. If you can get a sense of how those three counties, their results are coming in, that will give you a sense. One thing of note, DeKalb, surprisingly, and I say this very facetiously, has the fewest amount of early voting locations. Just coincidentally. So that's what we're looking at tonight. And here is Donald Trump trying to drive voters, presumably in Cobb and Fulton, white voters. And here is how he did that, through a really limp robocall.
Hello, this is President Donald Trump. Liberal Democrats from outside of Georgia are spending millions and millions of dollars trying to take your Republican congressional seat away from you. Don't let them do it. Tomorrow there's a special election for Congress in Georgia. Only you can stop the super liberal Democrats and Nancy Pelosi's group, and in particular, John Ossoff. If you don't vote tomorrow, Ossoff will raise your taxes, destroy your health care, and flood our country with illegal immigrants.
Now, two things stick out for me on this. One is that Nancy Pelosi has a group. I don't know what group that is. But that seems odd.
It's a girl group. They're terrible.
And listen, if you're talking about Nancy Pelosi here, what you're doing is you're immediately trying to trigger. Hold on, keep that up, Matt. You're trying to trigger the base, right? I mean, these are the people because broadly speaking, I think your average voter in Georgia probably doesn't know who Nancy Pelosi is. Secondly, you're also talking to morons who believe that John Ossoff, as a congressperson, will have the ability not only to outvote the majority of Republicans in the House and the Senate, but will also force Donald Trump to sign off on whatever it is that would destroy your health care.
John Ossoff has powers. I'll be forced to sign bills.
Flood your illegal immigrants.
He only wants black people to have health care. I won't want to sign it, but I'll be forced to because of him and Nancy Pelosi. Please help.
The group.
Yeah.
The group.
The group. The group is in power. I think we all know what their religion is.
All right. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, that interview with David Dayen. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome back to this program time after time after time again the great reporter for such outlets as In These Times, The American Prospect, The New Republic, The Intercept, The Fiscal Times, the Pacific Standard. I mean, anything, that The Nation Magazine, David Dayen. Hello, David.
Hello. I'm really hopeful at this point, since I've been on enough, that it's now the Majority Report with Sam Seder and David Dayen.
Well, it's pretty darn close. It's pretty darn close. So I don't know.
I want above the line credit is what I'm looking for.
Well, we'll work on that. That's negotiable. I should also say, author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, which is, as far as I know, multiple award-winning. Is that right?
Maybe single.
All right, fair enough.
I actually have my first royalty check coming in the mail for this little book.
Well, it's well-deserved. It's a great book and still gets referenced many times about the foreclosure crisis. And all right, but I want to talk about first, there's two different pieces of yours of the multitudes that you write on any given time that I want to talk about.
Yeah.
One is one that I spoke to you about on Ring of Fire a couple of weeks ago. And I, finished with asking, when are the hearings? And at that time you didn't know, but as this plays live on Tuesday, April 18th, you are testifying, in front of a committee of the, California State House about this very issue, and that is the issue of PBMs. What are PBMs?
Right. So PBMs is an acronym for pharmacy benefit managers. And if you pull out your healthcare card, you might see the name of a PBM on it. They are the people who manage your prescription drug benefit. Insurers essentially contract out to these specialists who work with drug manufacturers, who work with pharmacists, and manage all aspects of the prescription drug benefit that you receive through your health plan. And it started in the late 1960s, and they were just sort of claims administrators. They just pushed paper, made sure everybody got reimbursed, and made sure the benefits went through. Over time.
Now, wait a second. Before you get on to overtime, let me just say we're talking about places like Express Scripts, right? That's one I think that does.
Express Scripts is the biggest pharmacy benefit manager in the country. The second largest is CVS Caremark, which is a part of the pharmacy chain CVS. And the third is Optum Rx, which is a division of United Health. The insurance company actually bought this PBM. And if you take all three of those, you have about 80% of this market, or 180 million prescription drug benefit plans.
Okay, and back when they got set up, they were the ones who provided the, or basically channeled the reimbursements. Who are the different players that get reimbursements?
Right. So you have the pharmacy. When they make their prescription, they sell it to you, and then they get reimbursed by the PBM on the cost that they paid, because they don't get all the money from you, right? You pay a copay. So the other half of that comes from the pharmacy benefit managers. They negotiate with the drug companies to set the prices for these particular prescription drugs. Sometimes they get rebates from the drug manufacturer. And all that money in rebates and things eventually goes to the health plan. So they're sort of middlemen operating on behalf of the health plan, negotiating with every other side of the market. And the problem is that you have these multiple sides of the market, but only the PBM truly knows all the pricing information. Only they are distributing the money from the drug company to the health plan and to the pharmacy and eventually to the consumer. And that information advantage is what gives the PBM the ability to extract massive profits from every other side of this market and eventually raise the cost of prescription drugs.
So, okay, so the pharmacy has this bottle of, some drug.
Acetaminophen.
And so prescription strength acetaminophen.
And there you go.
I go to buy this because I got a bad headache from my kids. And
right.
The pharmacy says, okay, it's you only owe $10 because
right.
that's your copay. And
that's
the pharmacy gets a cost. It's actually $100, let's say. I don't know.
Right. Maybe the pharmacy pays a wholesaler for that drug, right? So the pharmacy pays a wholesaler $100, and they only collect $10 at the point of sale. So they're down $90 now. Now, when they go to their computer and say, I just sold this bottle of prescription strength acetaminophen, the pharmacy benefit manager at that point tells them, well, we're going to, because this is this person's plan, we're going to reimburse you X amount of dollars. And they literally don't know until they type it in. I mean, think about running a business where you're selling, milk, and you don't know how much you are going to get reimbursed. You don't know what you're going to get back for that milk that you've already paid for and put on your shelf until the moment that you sell it. That's how it works.
It's
hard to run a business this way.
So wait a second. So depending on what my health insurance is, my copay can be different and the actual cost to the pharmacy can be different.
Absolutely. And not only can it be different at that moment, but later on through the process, pharmacy benefit managers use a thing called direct and indirect remuneration fees, where they can claw back those reimbursements based on a certain number of performance characteristics. So you could sell something for $100, 3 months earlier, and then find out you're only getting $70 back because they clawed it back because of certain performance characteristics, like if the individual was taking his drugs in a timely manner, for example. So not only do you not know what you're going to get back for that drug at the time, but 3 months down the road, you could get money clawed back. It's impossible to be an independent pharmacist with the terrible terms that you're given on these contracts that you have to buy into, because there are only three of these companies that control pretty much the entire market. So if you can't hold out as a pharmacist and say, I'm not going to work with you guys, you give me bad contract terms, well, then you're cutting off, a third of your customer base. You can't do that. So
So wait a second. So let me ask you this. So how does the pharmacy have any way of like mitigating this? I mean, do they? They can't raise prices, right? Because there's no they're completely priced.
They're locked in.
They're locked in
on prices. You know, the decision that's made every day by independent pharmacists all over the country is, do we sell this product at a loss and keep this customer who might buy other things in our store, or do we say to this customer, I can't sell that to you because I'm going to lose too much money if I sell that to you, and watch that customer walk out the door? This is the decision that gets made on a daily basis, multiple times a day, by independent pharmacists. And it's no surprise that because of these very onerous terms, we're seeing the rise of chain pharmacies that are taking over, you know, much of the country. CVS is locked in with Caremark, a pharmacy benefit manager. They get very favorable terms on those particular prescriptions, and they have enough, you know, negotiating power to, you know, get better terms on the other PBMs. Same with Rite Aid and Walgreens, who are merging. And attempting to and explicitly have said that the reason they're merging is because they want to be able to negotiate better terms with pharmacy benefit managers. And, you know, the independents then get squeezed completely out of this deal. And it makes it very difficult for these particular mom and pop stores, retail stores, to survive.
OK, but that's not the worst of it.
Which no, is not, not
to
at all.
Diminish that, but so okay. So we have this dynamic where these PBMs basically dictate can really mess with the health of, I guess, these independent pharmacies. Where else does this monopoly that they have, three of them controlling 80%? We don't know. Back to that pharmacy store, even if it's Walgreens that is making a better deal with them. We don't know. Just because the PBMs charge $100, we don't really know if that's what the PBMs are paying for, right? I mean, their job is theoretically should just be to administer, but they could be marking up or hiding a rebate.
Here's the issue. Yes, PBMs negotiate with the drug companies, and they say to the drug companies, all right, you have a drug that you want to sell for $100. Tell you what, the $100 list price, you're going to give us a rebate of $30 off that. And the drug company, because they want to stay on what is known as the formulary, which is the list of reimbursable drugs from that PBM, which is a very crucial point of leverage in the system. The drug company says, fine, yeah, take $30 and out of that $100. Well, the PBM is under no obligation to pass that savings on to the health plan and subsequently the customer, they can change the name of what that rebate is. They can call it a pharmacy performance metric or some made up name and hide the rebate and keep it for themselves. And they do this routinely. And they also benefit on a thing called spread pricing, which is, they have a list of, we're going to pay this much money for this drug, right? And they give one set of books, essentially, to the pharmacy and another set of books to the health plan. And they could tell the health plan, oh, we reimburse that pharmacy $50. And then they can tell the pharmacy, we're reimbursing you $30, and keep the spread. And they do this over and over and over again because there is no transparency around what the PBM is actually making on every sale of a prescription drug. And so this raises costs throughout the system. It also creates a dynamic where the actual list price of a prescription drug has an incentive to be higher. And the reason is that the PBM
is getting a rebate.
They're getting a rebate, and you can get more rebates and higher rebates if that cost is higher.
If there's a higher markup, right? You can go back in and you can just inflate the retail price, and you call it a rebate so that it's not a lower price. It's just a kickback.
Right. It's just simple math that you can get a higher rebate off a $200 drug than you can off a $100 drug. This creates this dynamic. Now, those list prices are important. Even if you think, oh, but they're getting rebates back and they're passing them on. Even if they were passing them on, that list price is how the copay and deductible for a customer is derived. It's based on the list price. It's a percentage of the list price. Or excessive amounts of drugs kicks you into the donut hole where you have to pay for the entire drug yourself. That list price is very, very important, even if it doesn't reflect the actual cost that a health plan pays. So this creates this dynamic where prices are always increasing because the PBM wants it that way and the drug company wants it that way. And that creates more costs, both for the health plan, which eventually shows up in your premium prices, and for the customer itself.
Okay, so I got a couple questions here. What does the contract between the insurance company and the PBM look like that the insurance company can get so played by all this?
Right. So we don't have a ton of transparency on what that contract looks like. In fact, this bill, AB 315 in the California legislature that I'm testifying on, would force pharmacy benefit managers to become fiduciaries of the health plan that they're working for. In other words, they would have to act in the best interest of the health plan. Right now, they're not obligated to do that in most states and in most relationships between the health plan and the PBM. That's much like the fiduciary rule on investment advisors that the Trump administration is trying to deep six. So right now, the status quo is health plans don't have a lot of control, and there's a very good reason for that. Number one, they have very little choice. 80% of the market is three PBMs. And furthermore, they kind of divvy up the country. So even if you thought you had three choices, you really have one in most regions of the country. So what are they going
to
do?
And you can't go to the insurance company. You can't go to the drug manufacturers outside of the system because the PBMs can say to the drug manufacturers, look, if you deal without including us in, we take you off of our formulary. And so when someone comes right. in and I looks mean, for a painkiller, yeah. acetaminophen is just not going to be on there. That's going to be covered. We're just going to cover ibuprofen or whatever it is.
Right. They have leverage over the system, certainly in multiple points. And the truth is that these companies, whether it's a large company that self-insures and does their health plan in-house, or a large insurer, they're just not interested in getting involved in the nitty-gritty of prescription drugs. They see the PBMs as providing the service of convenience, not, they don't have to get involved with every single drug manufacturer and figure out the formularies and do all of those things that is very specialized. And PBMs have successfully argued that they provide value in this system. And so there's little choice. You can't shop around. And you kind of have to use one, or at least you bought into the argument that you have to use one. And so this is the result that you get.
So, all right, how does this work with Medicaid? Do the PBMs provide drugs for Medicaid patients? How does it interact in that way?
Yes, and Medicare Part D as well. Medicare Part D uses a PBM. You know, you hear about this, oh, we're not doing any competitive bidding in Medicare. Medicare uses a PBM to negotiate pricing with the health plan, with the drug manufacturers. And the same is with, you know, employee plans through a union it's a number of different. That's why I say sort of health plans is sort of the overriding term. But that can refer to an insurer, that can refer to a government agency. That can refer to a union health plan. That can refer to a large company. All of them go through the PBM as part of the pharmaceutical supply chain. and the PBM is making lots and lots of money off it. The top three PBMs, as I mentioned, Express Scripts, CVS Caremark, and Optum, are all in the top 22 of the Fortune 500 companies. These are massive, massive companies who have tremendous profits. By one standard, Express Scripts has raised their average adjusted profit per prescription 500% since 2003. Wow. So their margins keep going up and up and up and up and up. And that's owing to this lack of competition, lack of transparency, conflicts of interest, what have you.
So, I mean, do we have a sense of, I mean, if PBMs had a fiduciary duty, right, which is we're just going to take a specific percentage? I mean, what? How do...
Right. They could do something that, you know, there are so-called transparent PBMs. They don't have much of the market, but they say, we're going to take a flat administrative fee, and we're going to every rebate that we get with a drug company, we're going to pass along to you. We're going to be completely transparent about it. You're going to see all the cost information. You're going to see everything. And this is actually what California wants to do. Included in this bill not only is to make them a fiduciary, but to mandate the disclosure of cost information and all of the rebate information, everything on an annual basis, and to regulate PBMs through the Board of Pharmacy or the Department of Managed Health Care. They haven't decided.
Do we have a sense of if that was the case, let's say in California, but nationwide, if it were the case that PBMs operated under, I mean, it's an interesting, you draw this parallel, you know, the fiduciary duty with like a investment bankers on some level, because there's a real quality here to like, the selling the crappy securities. You know, on one hand, you're supposed to be my client, but really you're also
you're really
grist for my mill here.
Does
someone have an analysis of how much money people anticipate would be saved, or at least I guess would go to, presumably it would go to the consumer, right? Because the insurance...
Eventually it would flow down to the consumer. I mean, because of the lack of transparency in this system, it's hard to make that projection. But I think we know that this middleman would not take, you know, profits that have increased 500% since 2003 if they were asked to be fully transparent. And then a system presumably would emerge where there would be some competition to being gouged. If you knew you were being gouged, you would look for some alternative. So, I think you can say pretty clearly that would be the case. And you know, I mean, PBMs aren't just doing this. You know, the system isn't just legal and that's that. There are a number of lawsuits and enforcement actions that have been taken against this industry for deceptive practices, for illegal kickbacks, where the drug company says, yeah, get me on the formulary and here's your money. And that included a situation with OxyContin, where the health plan in West Virginia, which was operated by the state, said, we don't want you to continue to have OxyContin on the formulary, and Purdue Pharmaceuticals, through a kickback, paid the PBMs, and the PBMs said, we're going to keep it on there. And this is, you know, largely responsible for the opioid crisis. So it's not just that they're ripping people off. They're creating these situations where perhaps unnecessary treatments, perhaps excessive over-prescribing, all of these things where PBMs, if they were upright, could be a check on the system, they are shirking their duties. And so you have, I think that this kind of market is screaming out for some transparency, and we'll see what California is able to do. There are about 20 states that have some form of transparency in their arrangements with PBMs. One of the problems is The PBM might be in one state, the health plan might be in another, and the consumer ultimately might be in another. So they kind of work the system to find a venue where they can say they're not eligible for that transparency. That's why ultimately it's got to be done at a federal level. But, you know, California's a big enough state where it might be able to help.
Is there a state in the country where the transparency is actually effective? Like, it's too hard for them? I mean, I imagine California and New York would be two states, and Florida, let's say, would be two states where you would it would be tricky to, you know, really evade this stuff. But
it's hard because you can say, let's go for an example. You can say that, okay, you, the PBM, has to publish your what is known as a MAC list, the maximum allowable cost list. This is the list of how much they pay in reimbursements to a pharmacy, right? Well, the PBM can then just not call it a maximum allowable cost list and then try to say that, oh, we're not publishing that, so we don't have to disclose it. So, and that has happened. So it's just very difficult. It's kind of, you know, it's this endless race between regulators and the companies that they regulate. If it was a national solution and the language was tightened up, I think you'd get a better outcome.
So you'll be providing that testimony on Tuesday, the 18th, actually, while on the day that we released this conversation.
Yeah.
How long has that been bouncing around the California legislature? Or was this something that was inspired by your piece?
I don't think it was inspired by my piece. I know it wasn't. There's a member, Assembly Member Jim Wood, who's up in the Sonoma County area, who has been looking at this. He's actually a dentist, and he's been looking at this for the last 6 months to a year. Hmm. I think in my article hopefully provided some sort of reinforcement of the issues that he was looking at, and his chief of staff called me up, asked me to testify, and I'm happy to do so. It's an honor.
So do we have any sense though of what the potential savings are here? I mean, is it hundreds of billions of dollars? I imagine.
I mean, you're talking about an industry that obtains over $250 billion in revenue a year. So even if it's a small amount on their bottom line, you're talking about billions of dollars that ultimately will go back into the pockets of consumers, hopefully. I mean, either
this
directly.
This is the PBMs make, as an industry, make over $250 billion a year.
That's in revenue. I mean, that's not profit.
Right.
But yes.
That's
gross revenue.
Just seems stunning to me. Because they're a middleman. They're really
a very medicated society, Sam.
But they're also a middleman in between another middleman, right? I mean, this is like a middleman of a second order.
Right. I mean, another way of saying PBMs generate $250 billion in revenue a year is to say that the drug industry generates $250 billion in revenue.
Okay,
in other
so
words,
it all passes
the money's
through
all
them.
Going
okay.
through them. It
okay.
all passes through them. But they're a tremendous driver of these costs that are in the system, which we know have gone up in aggregate a tremendous amount. It's one of the largest, fastest growing parts of our healthcare system is the cost of prescription drugs. And they're at the heart of it.
All right. Amazing piece. People can check that out at American Prospect. In the meantime, let's move over to the piece that you wrote for, I think it's for The Nation on President Bannon is dead. Long live President Cohn. President Bannon, we know that he ran in to afoul of the globalists and liberals in the Trump White House. Tell us about Gary Cohn and give us a little bit of the palace intrigue, but also a broader sense of where this guy is on the sort of the policy spectrum.
Sure. So Gary Cohn is the head of the National Economic Council. He was the president of Goldman Sachs for a long time. He was a lifetime Goldman Sachs executive. And he comes into the National Economic Council, which is one of the few places within the Trump administration where he can just go ahead and hire people with expertise. He doesn't have to wait because those aren't confirmable positions. Unlike the Treasury Secretary or any other part of the government, the National Economic Council can just start hiring people. And he has hired lots and lots of people with policy expertise, and he's brought that to bear on the administration. And obviously, whether it's his alliance with Jared Kushner or the fact that he just has more horses, he has had a significant influence on President Trump. Last week, we saw Trump reverse himself on a number of policy positions in the course of just 24 to 48 hours. He reversed himself on about half a dozen major ideas, including the idea of, that China is managing and manipulating their currency. The support for the export.
Yeah, I don't want to blow through. I don't want to blow through that because the
okay, yeah.
Because the thing with China, and we played this clip on the program yesterday where he sat down with Maria Bartiromo, and he said a couple of things. Apparently, with the Chinese chairman. One, he found out that things were much trickier with North Korea than anybody knew, apparently.
Nobody knew that.
Knew that. He also basically made a deal. Now, people have to remember, and I'll just remind people, China. That was more than anything else, I think, in terms of foreign policy. That is, that was his sort of Alamo, right? What do you think about foreign policy? China is taking us to the cleaners.
Right.
And
people say that, he's making changes on economic policy, but, the latent racism, the kind of policies on immigration and policing, they're staying. Well, I would put the China stuff into that racism bucket. I mean, it was certainly this idea of a yellow menace that was coming to take all of our jobs and rip us off and immiserate the lives of hardworking people in the Midwest. I mean, that was at the heart of what he was talking about, and that has been completely reversed.
I mean, totally reversed, totally jettisoned. Yeah, about the China, the currency manipulation, which he was accusing China of.
Yeah, and people are, if you talk to economists, they'll tell you, China hasn't really been manipulating their currency for a while. You talk to Dean Baker, you get a completely different story of that, by the way. But everybody knows what the point is here, right? It's to loosen any kind of enforcement or crackdown on China's mercantilist policies, which really have created a depressed manufacturing environment in the United States. And that is the influence of Gary Cohn, of the, if you want to call him the globalist, to make things a little bit better for the multinational corporations who do a lot of business in China and don't want their supply chain disrupted.
And it is sort of stunning to me, and we should say, the stuff that's going on in immigration, I mean, we have one of our listeners, an immigration lawyer, and he is, it's stunning, what has happened in that accord. But that aside, it seems to me that this stuff is woefully underreported, A. B, I suspect it's because the Maria Bartiromo's, this is a huge comfort zone for, we should say, not just the Republican establishment, but also, I mean, Gary Cohn comes from arguably the Democratic establishment in many respects.
Right. He was a Democrat, registered Democrat, right up until Democrats passed Dodd-Frank, where he changed every one of his donations from Democrats to Republicans.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Then good. At least in that respect. There was some sense that he was unhappy with what the Democrats were doing, which I think is, but
probably a good thing. You're right. This is the comfortable, narrow range of, the sort of, neoliberal consensus or whatever you want to call it, of economic policy. Every single thing that Trump has shifted on has moved toward the very comfortable area where multinational corporations can do their business without any interference from the government, where taxes get lower and lower and lower, where financial deregulation continues apace, and where the sort of frameworks of the new globalization continue unfettered. So you have free trade, and you have the supply chains with China allowing to move forward, and the corporate welfare payments, like through the Export-Import Bank, continue to flow. And all of these things are precisely lined up with Gary Cohn's worldview.
What? Lastly, give me a sense of like where is there policy daylight between the pushing of the TPP, right, which ostensibly was, was sold in a myriad of different ways, but ostensibly it was to prevent the Chinese from setting the rules of the playing field in international trade. That's right. At least what we were told. Theoretically, it would give corporations more power, I guess, in negotiating with China for whatever reason. How does that juxtapose that with this notion of, like, I'm going to give China everything they want if they somehow magically wave their wand and take care of North Korea for me in some fashion? I don't know how they would do that.
Right. That kind of idea that we're willing to subordinate economic trade interests to geopolitical interests, that has been the status quo of this country for 40 years. That has been what every president has done from Carter on up. Here's the anecdote.
In terms of China,
in terms of the developing world in general. The leaders of this country have been willing to concede on interests affecting working people in America in order to promote their particular geopolitical agendas. That has happened over and over and over again. My dad worked in textiles, and in the 1970s, when he saw that the textile industry in America was falling apart, he went to Washington to petition lawmakers about this, and they all told him precisely this. They said, "We are selling out this industry for world peace." That is exactly what they told him. And that's kind of what you see Donald Trump doing. He's saying, look, we want to get a handle on the North Korean situation. China will give you whatever you want. We'll let your people continue to make our goods. We'll continue to buy them. We will not harass you in terms of the massive state support that you give these industries. And we'll let you go. And that's really, we're seeing this deja vu, and that has been, people don't like to use the word neoliberal, but that has been the neoliberal consensus for the last 40 years. And so, to answer your question about how that differs from the TPP, don't be surprised if the so-called renegotiation of NAFTA is just a reinsertion of the items they already agreed to in the TPP, because Mexico and Canada were in that. And that becomes what NAFTA renegotiates into, is the TPP. And it becomes a follow-on agreement that other countries in the Pacific Rim can sign on to.
But, so let me ask you this. I mean, in terms of that anecdote of your father, I mean, what was the calculation there in terms of world peace, A, and B, I mean, is it really
the calculation? Yeah.
Well, I mean, is it such a bad thing to trade away certain, trade benefits if it really does, if there's a way of demilitarizing North Korea? I have no illusion.
Well, the calculation at that time was, we have all these developing countries. They have hundreds of millions of people in them. Their workers have nothing to do, and they have no industry, and we need to set them up with industries where they can, you know, build up their middle class. And textiles is seen as one of those industries, as a sort of low to middle skill industry that we could put abroad and enable this rise that would limit the sort of social unrest that you have in these countries if you have a large numbers of people out of work. That was the consent. That was the argument back then. But it's become abstracted to the point that now you're just, if the country wants to reach certain geopolitical goals, then they will do the same thing with selling out workers in the United States. Now, whether or not you think that demilitarizing the 38th parallel, I think everyone thinks that's a good idea. But why must that be coupled with a policy that has a direct impact on tens of millions of workers in the United States? It's not, you know, all of a sudden, it has nothing to do with trade in general. It's not like you're going to site factories in North Korea. Now you're just trading favors and selling out workers in the process. And you can see how that would abstract until, you know, it the lives and well-being of the entire American middle class is a chip just to be bargained.
And we should say that's not the only arrow in one's quiver, theoretically.
Of course not.
And
yes,
it's the quiver, it's the arrow that basically is specifically at the cost of the broad base of American people as opposed to corporate interests, right? I mean, he could also say, like, hey, we're not going to worry about Disney's intellectual property, you know, for the last, if it goes back 50 years, you can have it. I mean, we'll open it up.
Right.
I mean, there's a whole host of property rights and, I guess, legacies and entitlements that they're protecting for corporations, but they won't protect for workers.
Right. What you're saying is there are a number of chips on the table, and the only one that gets bargained away is the worker chip, the intellectual property chip, the pharmaceutical patent chip, whatever other chip that affects large multinational corporations. Those chips never get played.
Right.
It's only the worker chip that is seen as something to concede to reach some sort of geopolitical goal.
And that's where we're at. Donald Trump has joined the party. Well, that was quick turnaround.
It certainly was. But all hail, you know, President Cohen. By the way, I mean, you know, you're talking about a guy who was president of Goldman Sachs when they were accused of ripping off investors and helping cause this catastrophic collapse in our economy. Gary Cohn was part of the coalition at Goldman Sachs that went to Greece to sell them on these risky debt instruments that actually very directly led to their 10-year-long depression with no end in sight. I mean, this is not the guy, in my view, that you want running economic policy out of the White House.
Well, we can only hope that Mike Cernovich has some real good dirt on all the orgies that Gary Cohn has been attending and pill popping and sugar babies or whatever it is that.
Right.
I mean, you know, that what's also interesting to me, there's sort of this like sigh of relief that Bannon's not in charge of anything, but some of the most odious of Bannon's ideas, i.e. Attacking immigrants in this country, still can perfectly function perfectly well, even if Gary Cohn is basically putting American corporations first and not America first, or however they seem to argue that.
Well, you're absolutely right. And there's been this sort of bifurcation where Jeff Sessions is running immigration policy and law enforcement policy, and Gary Cohn sort of has his hand in the economic policy bin. And those can coexist, absolutely. Bannonism can live on without Steve Bannon. But, you know, it's almost that you're getting the worst of all possible worlds.
Yep.
Because you're getting, you're getting the finance overall kind of policy on economics, and you're getting the very racialized demonization of immigrants and strong, tough on crime kind of law enforcement at the same time. So there's not one, there's no sort of respite here. In terms of what we're getting.
You got to wonder if Eric Cantor is not sitting somewhere in Virginia going, hey, what the hell?
Yeah.
This was my whole agenda.
Right. Now, what's interesting is I don't really think, I mean, there may be several schools of thought on this, but, you know, everything that Trump pivoted into in the past week would not be out of place in a Jeb Bush presidency.
Not
right?
at all.
And Jeb Bush, not exactly a popular figure within the Republican Party. So the question is, will the Breitbarts of the world, will the alt-righters of the world, will the that whole element of the conservative movement, which you can say helped lead Donald Trump to victory, at least in the primary, if not in the general election, are they going to turn their back now on this administration?
Give me your prediction about that, because mine would be there is a 0% chance of that happening, and that they, short of like Tim Carney, I don't think there was anybody in the Republican side who really cared about the XM Bank. And all of this stuff, as long as the rhetoric still remains, I don't think they care.
Well, it remains to be seen. I think the proof will be how the country contends economically, because if you believe that ceding the playing field to these large multinational corporations is going to lead to even larger forms of inequality and worse jobs and inability for upward mobility in key states, then I think that is going to have an effect on the approval ratings. And people will say that's just because of the economy. But, you know, you can argue that it's because of who was put in control of
right.
the economy. So I think that that will tell the tale in many respects.
David Dayan, always a pleasure. Good luck in front of the California lawmakers today, tomorrow, whenever people are listening to this. But I appreciate
All
your
right.
time.
All right. Thank you.
There you have it. David Dayan. Those pharmacy benefit managers, unbelievable. It is unbelievable. The sort of middle people, middle entities that get that basically are skimming cash off every which way they can.
I haven't read the story. I mean, you just explained it to me, but I find it very believable because there's so much cash in just floating around that for people not to, I mean, it's just, and it's unlimited. It just keeps coming.
These, all these companies, like, Dan said, Fortune 500, companies. All right. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Folks, a reminder. I had this conversation with my neighbor today. He's skeptical. Should he try JustCoffee.coop? This is the time to do it. You have 12 days left in April, or 13, depending on how many days are in April. I don't know. And I'm not going to look it up. 30 days then. So 12. MR Spring 17. Right now, go to your computer, JustCoffee, JustCoffee.coop. .coop. Use your coupon code MRSPRING17. You will get 30% off your coffee. It's free shipping. If you ever wanted to try Just Coffee, if you ever didn't want to try Just Coffee, now is the time to try Just Coffee. And I push this so hard, not because we're becoming millionaires off of the coffee. It's just, this is a great company. I still have a very, first of all, it's a co-op, so it's owned by everybody who works there. They do fair trade coffee for so everybody along down the line gets paid a fair wage. But also, and I think this has stuck with me now, it's been 6-7 years, but they were sending out coffee to all the protesters in Madison back during those big rallies against Walker 6 years ago now, I guess. So check it out. And also, they have the MR blend, which I read that email yesterday. That was not fake. That was real. My neighbor was like, was that actually real? And I guess, yes, there are people out there who are focused on single origin micro roasters. Not a bad thing. But I did not know that. So justcoffee.coop. Also, it is your membership that helps support this program. As you know, or maybe you don't know, but there was a piece in the New York Times about it today. Their YouTube has changed their algorithm and has basically swept up anybody who does news, or the vast majority of people who do news, and swept them up in some type of advertiser boycott. They're supposedly fixing it. We are not one of those people who will be automatically whitelisted. And so our revenue on YouTube has basically gone away. Our views are up, which is good, but the YouTube revenue has gone away. And so if you're one of those people who has the financial means to become a member of this program, as a bonus, we say, here's an extra hour of the podcast. But your support keeps this show chugging along, which is why, you know, I'm not in mourning about the YouTube thing, because this show has always been, like I say, 90-some-odd% of our revenue comes from members. So you can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com right now. Become a member. Also, MajorityReportKickback.com. If you buy your crap from Amazon or Jet.com, do so at MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on that link. Bookmark the either Amazon or Jet.com link. Always shop through there. We get a kickback. Michael sitting here tomorrow. I'll be back live Thursday. Michael will be live tomorrow. See you in the fun half, 646-257-3920.
Oh, I thought you were going to go a full second round there.
What?
I don't think it's okay. You're like...